Thank you for attending session 364 titled YouTube Mormonism. Before we begin, we ask that all cell phones are turned off and that those attending are respectful and attentive. We ask that we don't read that line again. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep in mind that when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session, following the remarks with the presenters, those who cannot abide by these guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends in the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone magazine at the registration desk as well. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Please don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. I want to introduce Jake Frost, the creator of the Brother Jake video series. He will give an in-depth presentation about his motivations for creating the series, followed by a Q&A. Jake has a master's degree in analytics / applied statistics from North Carolina State University and works as an analyst for a healthcare company. He started the Brother Jake series almost 2 years ago and recently started podcasting with Infants on Thrones. Everybody, please welcome Jake Frost.
Hi, I'm Brother Jake. Thank you to everyone for coming out today. I know this last session we're all pretty brain fried at this point. So here's a little popcorn. Just for a show, as a show of hands, who has seen or is familiar with the Brother Jake series? Okay, all right. I was wondering if there were any people that weren't. Anyway, in light of that, I'm actually going to start off with a little video that I made exclusively for Sunstone. So here you go. It's a couple minutes long.
Now, this is a story all about how my mind got flipped, turned upside down. And I'd like to take a minute to sit right there. I'll tell you how I became a Mormon that's more culturally aware. In Arizona, born and raised, and the chapel is where I spend most of my days. Commit a mission, BYU, and getting hitched up at the age of 22. When a guy came to church looking pretty cool, and started asking funny questions in my Sunday school. He said a couple of things that made me a bit scared, and I thought, I better get more culturally aware. I searched and researched day after day to find something that could help me on my way. When I found the link way out in the thick of the Sunstone, and figured, I might as well click it. Schedule, yo, this is crazy. Feminists, intellectuals, and gays? Is this what the Sunstone crowd is like? I don't know if this is right. I hear they are prostate, super rude, plus someone tells me they make some crazy food. I'm not sure, but I'll see when I get there, because I gotta take some risks to get culturally aware. The day finally came, and when I checked in, I started 3 straight days of a mental whirlwind. From the team of Salady to Finley and Fife, I learned lessons that I used for the rest of my life. The conference let out about 7 or 8, and I yelled to Mike Queen, yo homie, smell you later. I got in my Honda, and it blew everything.
Okay. See what you eat? Nothing else?
Okay. Will you
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's still working. Okay, well, you got the gist of it, right? Before I blew your eardrums out.
My bad.
No, it's what? All right. Hold on, we're back to this. Yeah. Okay, so... Sorry. Dang it. Okay, so... I'm glad you enjoyed the video. There are a few laughs there, right? And for all those Fresh Prince of Bel-Air fans, I ruined the theme song for you. Anyway, I'm very grateful to be to the Sunstone Foundation for allowing me to present this year's symposium. I'm always impressed by the content that Sunstone produces and the contribution it makes in furthering discussions about Mormonism. I think the only criticism I would have of the organization is the unbelievable oversight it made in allowing someone like me to present here. But It's too late now. They have your money. So what I'd like to do today, as Jake also alluded to, is describe the events that eventually led up to the creation of the Brother Jake series, as well as my thoughts on the series thus far, and all of which is very intimately connected to my roots in Mormonism and also my own Mormon mind, if you will. And I'd like to describe the trajectory of that relationship with that devilishly divisive feature of social media, which is the Facebook relationship status. So for all my upbringing, Mormonism and I would have probably fit pretty well in the interrelationship category. It probably won't surprise you to learn that the culturally aware video, the video that we just saw, is actually partially autobiographical. I was in eastern Arizona, born and raised in the chapel. That's where I spent. And as the youngest of eight children, and my mom is actually here today, right over here. She can say hi. She is deeply disappointed in me, as she should be. Right, right. We don't see eye to eye, but we still love each other, which is a great, I know, and you know, kudos to her for being so open-minded about that. Thank you, Mom. Love you. And while there are, Mormonism was deeply tied into our cultural upbringing, there's a million stories I could tell to illustrate this, but my personal favorite is the time that my parents strongly encouraged or forced us to sing Christmas carols to a family friend that we ran into in Taco Bell. So we ran into this friend in Taco Bell, and we said, oh, let's angels, we have her. And so we serenaded the whole thing. And that actually happened more than once. And one time, not even at Christmas. It was like in the middle of the... I think we sang like Sweet Hour of Prayer or something. We just sang hymns. It was, you know, different restaurants, Wendy's, Taco Bell, KFC. You know, we did pretty well. I'm not bragging. There are many experiences that helped me form, but there were many that helped me form my own personal connection to Mormonism, as opposed to a connection that was determined by my family and friends. Over time, you know, in the context of this metaphor, over time, Mormonism and I moved from the interrelationship to, I don't know, something like marriage, and domestic partnership, civil union, something. I'm not sure. It's not, you know, it's not a perfect metaphor, but the point is that Mormonism and I started getting pretty serious. So. One such formative experience was my father's sudden death just before my 10th birthday. I just killed the moo in the room. Just went way down. For a child, the death of a parent is incredibly disorienting. And in my experience, the sting of death isn't in what happens; it's in what fails to happen. The shared experiences you yearn for are the birthdays, the Christmases, the Halloweens, first days of school. High school musicals, camping trips, times you lose a youth church basketball game by 100 points and he buys you some Tampico to make you feel better, you know? Those experiences are irreparably lost and can't be recuperated. And that's in my experience, that's where I felt that sting of death. And up to that point, the mantra, families can be together forever, was... only a nice phrase to me. In the face of that yawning void, however, it went from being a catchy slogan to a potential lifeline of hope. And it was one that I tried to grasp as I delved as deeply into Mormonism as I could. And grasp it I did. My faith became an anchor to me. And in the years after that, I turned into something of an oddity in our ward as the only 12-year-old, as the only deacon who would get up every Sunday school, who would get up every fast and testimony meeting and bear a tearful testimony about the atonement and resurrection. It was incredibly important to me, my faith. Throughout my teenage years and my mission, I continued to have experiences that reinforced that my relationship was on that, you know, long-term committed relationship, end of the relationship spectrum. And, you know, if Mormonism and I were a Mormon couple, you know, it'd be pretty serious. I'm dating 3 or 4 months, maybe, you know. Very, very, very serious relationship. However, as you might have guessed, see, these are pictures of teenage years. This is actually one of my favorite pictures. You see this top picture right here? That's me and my mom. But this top picture is the epitome of the Eagle Scout ceremony. Look at my face, and look at her face. You can hear my eyes rolling. And she is just beaming. I think that's a perfect, perfect image of scouting in general. But anyway, this trend didn't continue forever. At some point, that relationship was thrown into question. And some of the initial catalysts for reevaluating my relationship with Mormonism were conversations that I had with a woman who would later become my wife, Erica, who is over here as well. Hi. And I'll do a shout out to her. We actually, yesterday, just celebrated our 5th anniversary. So, if we make it to 20, we're getting tattoos. But anyway, I came from my mission shortly after the 2008 election, and the more I learned about the church's involvement in passing Proposition 8, the more I felt that the conduct of the institution and my own views weren't really in line. And throughout our courtship and first years of marriage, this list of issues that caused this angst for me continued to grow. And in Facebook terms, I guess Mormonism and I kind of went to the it's complicated territory. So in many ways, I felt like I had a foot in two slowly diverging worlds. Phrases and ideas that had once been a source of great comfort to me now produced anxiety. And to illustrate this inversion of perspective, I had an experience in my mission that kind of illustrates this. So in my last exchange, I had a companion, an American companion, who had received a package from home, and he had two cans of root beer in there. And one of which he offered to share with me. I felt very, very, very blessed, so blessed. At that point, it had been almost 2 years since I'd had this nectar of the gods. So needless to say, I was pretty excited. I poured a glass, I poured it into my glass with some ice, and I put my face over it and let the carbonation bubbles tickle my nose. And it was an incredible moment. And I finally lifted it up, and I took a drink, and, it tasted like medicine. And there's a simple explanation for this, is that root beer tastes like medicine. It does. It does. It's like one of those things, it's like American football or Vegemite. It's like one of the people, you love them because you grew up with them and you foster an appreciation from an early age. But once you internalize that that appreciation, it's really hard to see it from an outside perspective. But after I had spent that... I knew dozens of Latin American missionaries that told me over and over and over, root beer's gross. And I would think, that's crazy. I mean, it's the best. But after I had been separated from it for that long, I had this, when I had it again, or when I drank it after that two-year root beer fast, I got a glimpse of what root beer could taste like from the outside. Somebody unfamiliar with root beer tasting root beer. And it permanently changed the way I see it. I mean, I still enjoy root beer. I'm not a monster. But, whenever I do, I can still taste that faint hint of medicine, and I kind of re-triggers that sensation of seeing something that I once saw that was once familiar from a strange perspective. And that was kind of my experience with Mormonism. So as I'm in these diverging worlds, my angst slowly grew and eventually crystallized in this conversation that I had with my wife after church one day. So she was serving as a young women's instructor at the time. And during that day's lesson, she had made some sort of comment to the young women about how the gospel or Mormonism can be complicated. And one of the other counselors disagreed really strongly with her. No, she insisted, the gospel is simple. And the gospel is simple, that's a phrase whose meaning had transformed for me as I'd reflected on the hundreds of hours I'd spent on my mission trying to explain the Mormon notion of the gospel from God's pattern of calling prophets to the cycle of prophets and apostasy to Christ's church, and then a great apostasy, then Joseph Smith being called a prophet, and then the Book of Mormon, and then, you get the idea. So, sneak peek. Spoiler alert. Anyway, we just wondered if there was some way that we could just lay it all out, if we could just boil this concept of the gospel just down to what you need to know and the contextual information you need to understand how important it is, and if you can just spit it out as one continuous thought, is there any way to kind of demonstrate that it could be complicated? There's some way to interpret this as something other than being simple. So we gave it a shot. And so, taking cues from Stephen Colbert, the satire of his TV personality, and then also the aesthetics and visual style and also the speed of John Green's Crash Course World History. It's a YouTube series. You should look it up. You'll learn a lot. John Green's in the crowd, everybody. Just kidding. That would be amazing. We would all be translated immediately. we gave it a shot, and we put together this first draft, and the brother Jake was born. And from the beginning, my wife, Erica, has been and continues to be an integral part of it. She is my editor-in-chief, and nothing I do gets out of, you know, leaves my computer without her explicit approval. So I'm very grateful for her. And we should all give her a hand for all the work that she's done. So, speaking of which, this kind of begs the question that I'm sure that a lot of you are asking yourselves, which is what exactly am I trying to accomplish? Because at the time, I didn't think about much about the choice to use humor and satire as the vehicle of expression. It seemed like a natural choice for me, so I just kind of went with it. But on further reflection, I think that decision really, to take the satirical angle, was an excellent fit for accomplishing what I wanted to accomplish with the series, which... You know, you're probably wondering what exactly am I trying to accomplish with the series. So I'd actually like to watch one of the videos, one of my personal favorites, and then kind of talk about how it accomplishes what I'm trying to accomplish. So let me set that up real quick.
Hi, I'm Brother Jake. Now, there are a lot of people out there that think believe about modesty is a sexist double standard or promotes a fear of sexuality, but that's not true at all. Let me explain. The thing is, our bodies are super... Hi, I'm Brother Jake. Now, there are a lot of people out there that think that what Mormons believe about modesty is a sexist double standard or promotes a fear of sexuality, but that's not true at all. Let me explain. The thing is, our bodies are a super awesome gift from God, and it's a really important part of His plan to give us commandments to keep our bodies safe from sin. And one of the worst sins you can commit with your body is breaking the law of chastity, which is the rule that you shouldn't have, you know, sex or anything before you're married, and only do, you know, with your spouse after you're married. And it's a pretty big deal for God. In fact, the Book of Mormon says that breaking the law of chastity is the third worst sin ever, right below murder. Anyway, the commandment of modesty tells us that we should all be nice and covered up in the way we dress so that people aren't tempted to do, you know. Now, there are some people that think that just because pretty much all the church curriculum and general conference statements about the subject of modesty are filled with very female-specific stuff and pretty much nothing male-specific, that means that the modesty policy is sexist. But that's not true. Modesty applies to everybody. So, you know, girls shouldn't wear stuff like really tight pants or short shorts or short skirts or bikinis or tank tops or spaghetti strap dresses or spaghetti strap shirts or sleeveless dresses or tube tops or low-cut shirts or shirts that show their stomachs. And guys shouldn't wear, like, I don't know, really short shorts either, I guess. Okay, so even if the subject of modesty in the church is a tiny bit female-oriented, that's not our fault. It's biology. After all, we all know that men are just burning bags of uncontrollable lust, while women are dainty, beautiful, innocent, asexual creatures. So if a dude walked around without a shirt on, women wouldn't even notice because they're not into that kind of thing. But if a woman has bare shoulders, it's way more likely to cause a dude to have those super bad thoughts about, you know, if only there was some modern-day apostle that could put this in a way that's totally not hyperbolic or objectifying at all. Oh, yeah.
And young women, please understand that if you dress immodestly, you are magnifying this problem by becoming pornography to some of the men who see you.
Exactly. So it's not our fault if there's more stuff targeted at women when we talk about modesty, because when women dress immodestly, it's going to be way more likely to make men have bad thoughts. And you don't want to make somebody more likely to commit those almost as bad as murder type sins, do you? And sure, looking at female modesty that way might kind of seem like it's reinforcing a rape culture where women are responsible for men's behavior, which kind of makes you wonder why men don't just take responsibility for their own freaking thoughts and actions and stop blaming their problems on other people. But like I said, it's just the way men are. So, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, everyone knows that the idea that women can subdue male urges by being more covered up is totally legit and doesn't fly in the face of rigorous studies on sexual violence at all. Plus, what else are we supposed to do when the morally eroded, terrible, awful, wicked society that we live in constantly sexualizes women? We're just trying to teach them to stay modest so that everyone can be pure and virtuous and we can make God happy. Just like this nice lady church leader says.
Never hesitate to teach them that they are royal daughters of God and that their value is not based on their sensual appeal.
Exactly. We're trying to unsexualize women. We're doing the opposite of what society is doing. I mean, sure, I guess you could say, but constantly reinforcing the idea to young women they have to cover their bodies to avoid being too sexual draws so much attention to the connection between the female figure and sexual appeal that it actually sexualizes and objectifies them just as much as any billboard with bikinis on it. But that's just crazy. How does telling a 5-year-old girl not to wear sleeveless dresses because it's immodest and she needs to cover up her body reinforce a sexualized body image more than a movie where a woman has bare shoulders? The first stuff is helping people grow up to stay pure and righteous, while the other stuff is a temptation from the devil to try to get people to do super bad stuff. They're totally different. Plus, this whole modesty thing isn't about just helping people to avoid sin. It's about helping you find the right person to marry later on, just like this nice church leader says.
In the end, most women get the type of man they dress for.
Exactly. That's why we have that awesome saying, modest is hottest. Because dressing modestly is the only way to be really attractive to a person that's pure and righteous and going to help you get into super awesome VIP temples and super awesome VIP heaven so you can do cool God stuff. And sure, it might seem like kind of a contradictory message to, on one hand, accept the paradigm that one of the purposes of female dress and appearance is to attract a mate, and on the other, maintain the idea that the purpose of female modesty is to help men avoid having bad thoughts and commit sin. But that's why it's so great that we have access to prophetic counsel to help young women everywhere navigate their appearance and body image from a group of super cool elderly white gentlemen. Now, at this point, you might still be saying, but obsessing about sexual purity to the point that it dictates how you dress creates a collective mentality that promotes a fear-based view of sex and intimacy, which can cripple a person emotionally later on in life. But that's not true at all. We're not promoting fear about, you know, sex is a really important part of God's plan for these really awesome bodies he gave us. After all, it's how we get families. We just think that people should respect their bodies and sexuality. And just like any other really awesome thing you respect, like lightning or a velociraptor or a grizzly bear, it's important to be safe with it so you don't go around committing sins that are almost as bad as murder. Think about it like this. Our sexual virtue is like a piece of gum. Everybody loves gum, but when you know, it's like somebody chewed your gum up. And nobody wants a chewed up piece of gum, am I right? And getting to the point where you're having relations is a slippery slope. It starts off with a short skirt or a tank top, and the next thing you know, your gum's all chewed and it has dirt and bugs and lint and all kinds of stuff in it. Nobody wants that gum. So in the end, it's better to stay far away from that kind of thing by covering up your awesome body that you're totally not afraid of at all, so you don't become a chewed up piece of gum that nobody wants. So you see, it's all about respect.
Okay. Great. So in the context of that video, I just wanted to talk about what I want to accomplish with the Brother Jake series, or what I hope to accomplish. First of all, as I mentioned before, looking for a way to illustrate my changing worldview, I wanted to find a way to illustrate this changing worldview to those who otherwise couldn't understand my point of view. As John Cleese of Monty Python fame said, if I can persuade you to laugh at a particular point I make, by laughing at it, you acknowledge its truth. So this is something, all of those explanations of modesty are ones that I heard. I didn't make those up. And those are things that, not only did I not make those up, those are ones that I taught people when I was a missionary. That was a worldview that I accepted, and it was a worldview that I internalized. I remembered how it was to look at those, to hear those explanations, actually draw comfort from them, and think, they're making a lot of sense here. You know, chewed up piece of gum, you're irreparably, you know, damaged. So that was something that I really internalized. So being able to take that, invert it or change the context a little bit or just heighten the reality a little bit to be able to demonstrate how it would look from an outside perspective was something that I was that I wanted to do. It's in the same way that singing the tune of Happy Birthday in a minor key can change the song from a lighthearted celebration to a somber contemplation of the passage of time and your inevitable death. Satire can take a familiar phrase for some familiar phrases and ideas, and by altering how they're presented, change how one sees them. In satirizing certain aspects of Mormonism, in the context of this video, the messaging about modesty and the messaging about sexual purity, I intend to point out important problems and real problems that I see in the underlying beliefs or cultural quirks of Mormonism, whatever you want to chalk those up to. So the second motivation for the Brother Jake series, however, is more inwardly focused. In essence, the videos have been a form of therapy to help me deal with the emotional angst caused by the sensation of being at odds with what was once my emotional base. Up to this point, I've treated my faith transition with quite a bit of levity. I mean, you know, the Root Beer story is kind of a nice story, but you know, it's cute, but it's pretty trite. I mean, I'm talking about soft drink. The fact of the matter is the process was deeply painful for me. And in many ways, my relationship with Mormonism kind of went from less from it's complicated to widowed. For many, losing one's faith includes a sense of loss or grief that's similar to the death of a loved one. And in the face of that void, being able to laugh in those moments of deep sorrow can be very therapeutic. I'm reminded of an experience that I had in the wake of my father's funeral. So the funeral and burial reception, everything of that had gone smoothly, and our last guests were leaving and giving their heartfelt condolences. We sat in the living room, and as they drove away, an enveloping silence fell on the room. And the last few days had been horrific, but the sheer amount of logistics required to deal with the death and aftermath had occupied all the free space in our minds. However, with the departure of the final guest from the final event, we were finally free to confront the gravity of the loss that we suffered and contemplate the sheer and unending emptiness it represented. The silence only carried on for a minute or two, but it seemed unending. And I started to wonder if I'd ever emerge from that despair that settled over me. It was in that moment that one of my siblings decided to tell a memory of my dad. He had asked my brothers to go outside and gather up some firewood, and as young boys often do, they got distracted and were playing around and hadn't done their thing. So he came out, and he was understandably furious, and he let one of his rare swear words fly to show him that he was, you know, serious. I don't really think he thought through his word choice, though, because the phrase that he settled down on was, "All right, you bastards, you better hurry up!" Which is a word with some curious connotations, coming from a father to his children. to say the least. It was just a little... I mean, they were so scared by the swear word that they just did it, but I think if I heard it now, I'd be like, "Wait, you don't say that?" perhaps this story seems a bit crass or out of place, and I'm sure I'm on Lindsay's bad side for having used a cuss in here. But it couldn't have been more appropriate in that context. It broke that deep sadness that besieged us, and it kicked off one of the best storytelling sessions I've ever been a part of. We laughed more that night than we had in many days, and for the first time since my dad's stroke, I was able to sleep through the night. And I believe that the Brother Jake series provides a similar humorous outlet for people undergoing emotionally tragic event, as evidenced by the dozens of messages I've received from the audience members that thanking me for the series and indicating that it allowed them to laugh in a difficult time in their lives. Given these two objectives, I wonder how well I'm fulfilling them, and the answer is, I don't know. On one hand, I understand the criticism that the videos are a simplistic depiction of complicated theological questions, and that the unrelenting satirical bent of the videos could breed cynicism instead of understanding. On the other, I never intended the videos to be kind of the end-all, be-all statement on a certain subject, but rather a jumping-off point for discussion. Like most satire, it's intentionally one-sided and distorted to make a commentary on its content, but not to be the final definitive statement. Also, it's important to keep in mind that I really didn't set out to create a comprehensive anthology of Mormonism, of Mormon beliefs. The series has been, from the beginning, an attempt to deal with the angst and sorrow that I felt as my relationship with Mormonism changed, and I'd never dreamed that it would become as popular as it has been. So, as for the future of the series, I'm not really sure about that either. I have a laundry list of subjects I still want to address and get to. I'm not sure how long the drive to express myself in the medium will last. If and when it finally does burn out, however, I'm confident that I'll feel satisfied in what I was. In what I was able to produce. In the enveloping sadness of a relationship lost, I created an avenue to break the silence in the most powerful way that I knew how, with joy and laughter. Thank you. I'm free to take questions. I don't really know what happens now. so we have another probably 25 minutes or so. So I'm... Q&A? Another video? Yeah? All right. Let's go see another one. Well, my personal favorite at the moment, and this may be a recency bias, but I really enjoyed making the Mormons Do Not Hate Gay People, which is the most recent of the videos. Is there some interest in seeing that? All right. Let's watch it.
And then do Abraham, and then do Isaac.
All right, that'll be fun. We'll just have a good time. We'll laugh it up. I like that.
Hi, I'm Brother Jake. Now, there are a lot of people out there who say that Mormons don't like people that are gay.
Okay.
From same-sex attraction, but that's not true at all.
Sorry. Sorry, pulled up in a different program, blah, blah, blah. All right. We'll get it.
It's too loud.
Hi, I'm Brother Jake. There are a lot of people out there who say that Mormons don't like people that are gay. Suffering from same-sex attraction, but that's not true at all. Let me explain. I mean, sure, there have been a few times when prophets and apostles had said stuff that might not seem super positive about those type of people, like this.
Homosexuality is an ugly sin. The ancient cities of Sodom and Gomorrah are symbols of wretched wickedness, more especially related to their perversion.
Or this.
Some suppose that they were preset and cannot overcome what they feel are inborn tendencies toward the impure and the unnatural. Not so. Why would our Heavenly Father do that to anyone?
But the reality is that we totally love people who are same-sex attracted. And I bet having to deal with all that being same-sex attracted and whatnot, it's super hard. But there's this thing called the law of chastity, which I've talked about before, and that's where God commanded that doing stuff like having, you know, sex with somebody you're not married to is almost as bad as murdering somebody, and that applies to everyone. So it's not like we're singling same-sex attracted people out or anything. We're just saying that they have to live the law of chastity just like everyone else. So that's it. Problem solved. Well, kind of. I mean, I guess you could say that there's some difference in how the law of chastity works for people who are gay because of one teeny tiny thing, which is that while there's some opportunity for normal people to experience the dozens of avenues of romantic and emotional validation that can be pursued before marriage, like flirting or going on dates or hugging or kissing or holding hands or cuddling, as well as a fully sexual relationship with someone to whom they're attracted after marriage, there's really no acceptable way for gay people to act on their sex drive ever in any way at all, because while we totally don't hate gay people, like I said, we're really not into people, you know, acting gay. But that's just because we're super big fans of traditional marriage, and we think that's the only type of marriage that should be legally allowed. Now, at this point, you might be wondering what exactly it is that makes a marriage traditional. Like, is it the tradition to marry for love rather than the earlier non-traditional tradition of marrying for economic or political reasons? Or is it the tradition of committing to sexual fidelity with your spouse? Or is it the tradition of promising to support each other in sickness and health and care for any dependents that might come along? Well, no. I mean, those are all good things, don't get me wrong, but the thing that really makes a marriage traditional comes down to the genders of the people in it. See, a traditional marriage needs a man and a woman, and we know that because in the biblical account of the creation, it only mentions a man and a woman, and obviously anything not specifically mentioned in that story must be stuff that God doesn't like. After all, it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and his really good friend Patrick, who always wears cardigans and for some reason is in all of Adam's Christmas cards. And sure, it might seem a bit shaky to adhere to such strict literalism for that particular passage, since that part of the Bible also includes a talking snake, a fruit that could grant you knowledge just by eating it, and a magical garden where nothing ever died. Oh, plus, if we are going by the every type of marriage not mentioned in the Adam and Eve story is out of bounds idea, that puts Mormons in a bit of an awkward position since we used to practice, and technically still do in our temples, which I talked about in another video, a form of marriage that includes one man and multiple women, but that's just for special occasions when God really needs it, like with Abraham or Joseph Smith or Brigham Young. The bottom line is that although there are people who are saying that it's okay for a marriage to have two men or like two women with no man at all, I guess, in order to be traditional, a marriage needs at least one, but, you know, sometimes more women, and one and only one man. Now, at this point, you might be thinking, but reducing the definition of traditional marriage to an issue of gender rather than focusing on arguably more important elements of the institution, like the long-term commitment of fidelity and love, is incredibly simplistic and short-sighted, but we're not making the rules God is. And although the perception of the institution of marriage has shifted significantly over history from being primarily an arranged union used to transfer property or political power to the modern notion of a mutual declaration of love and commitment, we're 100% positive that having the correct number of men and women is definitely the one thing that makes traditional marriage, well, traditional. And yes, even if we do accept that totally airtight premise for establishing what a traditional marriage is, it may still kind of seem like a violation of the separation of church and state to use religious conviction as a basis for maintaining laws that restrict the type of unions the state recognizes, but like I said in an earlier video, this is a Christian nation, so it's totally cool to enact public policy based on Christian theology. The thing you need to understand here is that traditional marriage is like super important for society. And just like it says in our Proclamation on the Family, any changes to traditional marriage will have huge negative consequences, especially for children. See, the most obvious problem with letting people of the same gender get married is because they can't have kids, since you need a man and a woman to make a child. And that's not me being mean or anything. That's just science. I mean, yeah, reducing the purpose of marriage strictly down to biological reproduction might seem a tad inconsistent, since by that same logic, we should probably stop granting heterosexual marriages to couples who are elderly or infertile, but it goes beyond just having kids, it's about raising them, too.
Unmarried mothers have massive challenges, and the evidence is clear that their children are at a significant disadvantage when compared with children raised by married parents. We should assume the same disadvantages for children raised by couples of the same gender.
Exactly. Children born to single parents have big disadvantages, and extrapolating that those disadvantages will apply to children raised by two parents of the same gender is totally logical, since the difficulties of being a single parent don't stem from the overwhelming correlation between single parenthood and poverty or low education or lack of resources. It's all because a single parent household only has one gender in it. And since, like I talked about before, men and women have divinely mandated separate but equal family roles that just so happen to align with 20th century gender ideals, and since the value of each parent's contribution to the complex and arduous process of child rearing can be primarily accounted for by the anatomy they were born with, obviously children in a home with parents with the same parts will be lacking the advantages and completeness that they would have had if their parents had different parts. Anyway, the other big problem with same-sex marriage is that if it becomes legal, it'll kind of make it so that not as many people get normal married. And I definitely have well-reasoned points for saying that. I mean, sure, it might seem a tiny bit strange for me to argue that allowing consenting adults of the same gender to enter a state-sponsored legal agreement that was historically only available to adults of the opposite gender is going to somehow ruin that agreement for the non-gay people, since the people getting gay married are, I've been told, actually gay, so it's not like they'd be getting married to people of the opposite gender anyway, But hear me out. If gay marriage is legal, maybe more people will become gay, so then some people who would have gotten normal married won't. And yeah, saying that kind of flies in the face of a large and ongoing body of research that indicates that pretty much everyone who self-identifies as gay doesn't really choose to be attracted to people of the same gender in the same way that pretty much all the non-gay people don't choose to be attracted to people of the opposite gender. But think about it. There are way more gay people out there than there were like 100 years ago. I mean, sure, that might just be due to a societal trend toward removing the stigma against homosexuality over the past century that has allowed gay people to feel more comfortable about admitting that they're gay instead of just hiding it, getting normal married, and then living out nice, quiet, sexually dysfunctional lives. So it might not be that people are being, like, converted to gayism or whatever so much as that a larger percentage of people who are already gay are just being more open about it. But it's like this. Imagine you have a pie, like a beautiful, perfect, traditional pie. But then this kid named Kevin comes up and he's like, I have a pie too. But it's like, it has like ice cream in it and the crust is made out of cookies or something. It's just not the same. The thing is that Kevin having that thing and calling it a pie just makes the pie you're eating not as good, because pie is pie. And if it's not pie, then it's something else. And what he has isn't pie, man. It's just not. And if that's a pie, who's to say that this isn't a pie? Or this? Or this? And pretty soon, everyone's just walking around with whatever they want, calling it pie, until it's like the word pie doesn't mean anything anymore, so what's the point of having any pie at all? And then the pie is ruined for everybody. It's just wrong, and it's unnatural, and it's gross. I mean, it's not gross. We really don't hate gay people at all, I swear. We even have a website about how much we don't hate gays. So, there you go. It's not natural. I mean, yeah, homosexual interaction is actually surprisingly common in the animal kingdom, but it's like this.
People inquire about our position on those who consider themselves so-called gays and lesbians. My response is that we love them as sons and daughters of God. They may have certain inclinations which are powerful and which may be difficult to control. Most people have inclinations of one kind or another at various times.
Exactly. We love gay people, but we were put on this earth to be tested, and everyone's got their own temptations and difficulties that they have to work through. Say, for example, there was a guy who was like a super kleptomaniac, just like overcome with a desire to steal stuff. But since stealing is wrong, he has to resist that temptation for his whole life. But if he does, after he dies, he'll be cured of wanting to do all the bad stuff, and he'll get to go to super VIP heaven and do cool God stuff. It's the same thing with gay people. Sure, being born in a gay body is super hard, no question about it. And we're not saying that you can be changed through reparative therapy or anything. Well, not anymore, anyway. We're just saying that if gay people just hang on and keep the law of chastity in this life, they'll be able to get resurrected in a not-gay body and get married to, I don't know, some lady who never got married and is just, like, hanging out, I guess? Unless the gay person was a lady, then she'd probably get, like, married to some super righteous dude as one of his wives. But anyway, God will figure it all out. The point is that if they just keep the commandments, they can get into super VIP heaven just like anybody. Now, at this point, you might be saying, but equating something as fundamental to somebody's personality as sexual identity and the desire for intimacy and connection with a disorder with such obvious social harms and selfish motivation as kleptomania trivializes the sacrifice of complete and utter lifelong celibacy that gay Mormons are being asked to make, but it's super VIP heaven. Think about it. It's like, what, 70, 80 years of constantly repressing the desire for romance and companionship and family for like a bazillion years of doing cool God stuff with somebody you got paired up with from among the righteous loners left over after death. It's totally worth it. Eternal perspective, man. So you see, we don't hate gay people. We just love families.
That's interesting. One commentary about that, and then I'll do the Abraham one, I guess, is the unless anyone has a question. Which they probably don't. Anyway, an interesting commentary about this, about that video, is that Erica and I, toward the end of my mission, were exchanging tapes. Well, they were actually CDs, but anyway. I was asking her about, I don't know, how things were going or whatever. She was talking about how she was disappointed in the way the church was acting about in regards to Proposition 8. And we had a whole conversation about homosexuality. And I was Brother Jake. I have it recorded. I have those files still, and at some point I'm going to dig them out and listen to them again. But I mean, I was that person. I mean, I was Brother Jake. It's kind of a mask I put on now. But it's the reason that I'm able to do it so well is because I was that person. So it's important to see how far you come or whatever. Yes.
I got a question. I mean, I would love to keep watching videos too as much as everyone else. But I'm curious if you could share a story with us about some of the more negative feedback you've gotten.
Yeah.
Either both sides, either from a more TBM active side or
right,
from others who might have been offended.
Yeah, so, I mean, I've had a couple exchanges with people on that front. Most of the negative feedback comes from believing people that, active believing Mormons that are offended by the content of the videos. But there are some people that reach out to me and been offended, not understanding that they're satirical. And so even this one is like, I understand what you're trying to do, man, but this is, the things you're saying about gay people are totally wrong. And I was like, yeah. And all this guy's making a lot of sense. That's fairly rare, actually. Most of the negative feedback is from believing people that are offended because of making fun of Mormonism or making light of the faith. In most cases, in almost every case, those negative interactions have ended cordially. So I've had a few people that reach out to me on the email account that's associated with the YouTube channel. And at the end of this, I'm going to write it up here if anyone wants to email me. I've had a few conversations with people like that, but they've been abrasive at first, but then we've gone back and forth, and all of them so far have ended with, well, I disagree with what you're saying, but, you know, namaste, and carry on. So it's similar to the interaction that actually the equilibrium my mom and I have landed on. It's, you know, we don't agree, but we can still be cordial with one another. So fortunately, I've actually had even the negative responses have ended up being positive experiences overall. Yes?
Have you ever completed an entire video and then you realized that it was just trash and you just threw it away and just didn't even try to do it?
Yeah, well, I've never gotten to the animation stage that way. And that's thanks to Erica, because she'll never let a script go by that doesn't pass muster. But yes, I have written entire scripts that I've torn up or just tabled. So I tried to write that Mormons don't hate gay people. Like that, the premise of that video I tried to write over a year ago, but I just couldn't nail it down. It wasn't coming together. It felt really disjointed, and so I just tabled it, and then it finally came. You know, I was finally able to do it later. So yeah, I mean, I'm not shy about it. At any point, if I don't feel like something's up to snuff, I don't have any qualms about trashing it. I mean, it's painful because time lost, but yeah. Yeah, so Eastern Arizona, you probably couldn't see it on the map, but it's a little town called Show-Low, Arizona. S-H-O-W space L-O-W. Oh, cool. Yes, that's... I bet you probably know my mom. yes, over here.
So one of the videos that I think took me the longest to finally watch, but ultimately was like one of the most therapeutic, was Mormonism is not a cult. Sorry, the C word.
Right.
Wait, that's not better.
Yeah.
I was curious, was either that video or are any of them, like, after making it, I mean, what was... Is there any confliction ever? Was there ever been a moment where you're kind of like, maybe...
Yes.
For me, that's like, it's almost, that's one of the, even though I disrespect from the church, it's still one of those words that, like, kind of makes you cringe a little bit. Cause I think it's
right.
Offensive.
And I agree. That's actually the video that I feel most conflicted about. And I have all the videos on this thumb drive except for that video because I feel a little bit. And if anyone asked for it, I was going to act like it was a mistake. Like, whoa, I can't. I knew I was going to forget one, but that was actually the one. I didn't bring that along purposely because I do feel conflicted about it because I think that just because the word doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's unambiguously pejorative toward a certain group of people, but it's the definition is completely ambiguous. So it basically it's just a word that's used to marginalize people you don't like. And so, but it was something that was kind of like, I do feel conflicted about it. What I can say is that I do believe that everything that I put in that video are aspects of the church that I do think are overly controlling and that I don't think are healthy. But, you know, as that I do feel conflicted about that one. I think there was one over here. Oh, sorry, I missed you. Yeah.
I was going to say, don't beat yourself up. Many of us gay Mormons... go through a self-hating Brother Jake way too long of a period. So,
well, you mean like a period where you was like, oh, I can't believe that I thought those things about those people.
I went through many years of probably being the most homophobic person in this room.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what to do with that other than sorry to all my gay brothers and sisters.
Yeah, and that's something that I mean, these videos are an apology in a lot of ways.
But I'm also apologizing. I was a self-hating gay person, too. And let's not beat ourselves up.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Yes, over here.
So the Gospel Topics video.
Yes.
There's a little bit of a separation of approach on that one. I was wondering if you could talk about that. I noticed Erica's in that one.
Right.
And can you just discuss why you took that approach on that one versus the traditional Brother Jim?
Oh, I just wanted to mix it up a little bit. And it was actually, I think it came from a conversation that we had. I think it was Erica's idea, like, do it like an infomercial. And because I was thinking about, like, how do I, because each topic goes so, you know, it's into a very specific subject. And so it's really, how do you treat the concept of the gospel topics as a whole without getting lost in the content of each essay? And so that seemed to be an avenue that would do that. But yes, it's a very different. It's the most unique video. Yeah.
I think your cult was very important. So don't, like, please stay. To a lot of people, it's very important for the harm that the religion has done. So it has deep meaning.
Mm.
And we don't have to be honest. Like, it doesn't have to be.
Right.
So which one's the most popular one?
Oh, the most watched one is Book of Abraham, by far. So that one is... Well, not by far, but yeah, that's definitely the lead. I think it has about 25,000 views.
That's 30,000.
30,000. Well, look at that. I'm not. Right. Yes. Yeah. It's not 30,000 people. I'm sure that people watch them more than once. Yes. And then.
You know, Dr. Lynn had his moment when he 10 years ago bought his mic. Mm-hmm.
I did have a moment, that moment of the gospel symbol video and that conversation kind of clicked the initiation of the series, but I've never really felt much apprehension about it just because, I don't know why, maybe I should have been more afraid, but I never really felt that much apprehension about it because I felt like if I got into a situation with church discipline, then I'd deal with that when I dealt with it. But in terms of, like, you know, he expressed feelings of fear for physical harm, and that was never anything that I really felt. So No, I guess not. In some ways, yes. In some ways, no. Yes.
Yeah, you talked about this a little bit with how when you were going through your transition, it was based on a conversation you had with your wife. But how did that really work? Like, were you and Erica on the same page the whole time? Was one of you ahead of the other?
Well, so Erica's always been a bit like, she grew up, you know, with parents who are Democrats in Provo, Utah. So she's always been kind of like on the outside of the, you know, she's always been kind of on the fringe in some ways. And her parents are right here. These are my in-laws. Okay, not Democrats like in, yeah, not Democrats. One Democrat, one Republican. But even one Democrat is, you know, So. Independent Mormons. Okay, yes. Yeah, so they've been coming to, I mean, Catherine, how long have you been coming to Sunstone?
30 years.
Yeah, 30 years. She gave one of the, you know, keynote speeches last year. She's a very well-respected historian who knows a lot of things. So Erica's always been kind of on the fringes of that. And I think in that way she had a lot more, she was flexible, whereas maybe my faith was more literalistic and, if you want to call it stronger, then yeah, but it was more brittle. So my reaction, if you look at, like, if belief is the spectrum, you know, Erica maybe has shifted this much, and I've kind of, you know, flipped. You know, I've raced by her on the other side. So, and in a lot of ways, she's been very accommodating to, as I've been doing these things, accommodating to me expressing myself. But I think in a lot of ways, me doing that has pushed out, or kind of pushed out that the safe space where she can express feelings of belief. So she's been very accommodating to my expressions of unbelief. I haven't squashed them, but it's just like I haven't actively tried to create a safe space for expressions of belief. So ultimately, I'm not, you know, I don't know if we're necessarily on the same page, but it was similar enough that it wasn't a point of conflict. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So the process is, the first stage is always writing. So that takes about a week. I mean, it all told it takes about 20 hours of work to write the script. But that, I kind of have to space it out. I can only do so much in a day because I'm too close to the script to be able to really see where it should go. So I have to space it out. And so research and writing takes about a week. And then once I have that, then I record it. And that, I mean, this isn't one take. You know, these are multiple recordings. No one can talk that fast. I hope. If someone could, I don't even know what I would do. But anyway, I don't speak that quickly, obviously. So multiple takes in the recording, that takes, you know, 3 or 4 hours. And then probably about 20 hours in the animation. I use an online program. It's called Powtoon. Powtoon. If anyone's interested in that, it's super easy to use. You just lay down an audio track, and then you can import images, and you have simple options for animations. It can zoom in to the left or the right. So it's super user friendly, and for someone like me who has very little skills with technological skills with animating and that type of thing, that it was a godsend. So that's how I do it, and then I download it from there. You can pay for HD downloads or whatever, and you download the file and then upload it to YouTube. So, yes?
About 3 minutes.
What?
About 3 minutes.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So,
Other than the infomercial one, is that we've thought of doing a sister tape where the content really lends itself to be a female voice narrating this.
That's an interesting question, and that's a question that I hadn't considered that much up until this, and I have actually gotten that question before. It's not something I've considered very much up to this point, but it's definitely something I'm taking into consideration now. So, you know,
you've got to talk about enrichment
and donating. Right. So maybe Sister Erica, huh? We'll see. Let's take one more question, then wrap up. Yeah.
Do you have a day job, and do you get compensated for these videos?
Yes, I have a day job. I'm essentially applied statistician, data analyst for a healthcare organization. So I do population health management analytics. So that's very, very far away from this. And in terms of compensation for this, no. I've considered monetizing so you can monetize YouTube channels. If you pass a certain threshold of clicks, then every additional click, there's some revenue that goes your way. I haven't done that up to this point. mostly because I am concerned that I would expose myself to some issue with like the images that I use, because under fair use education, under the educational clause of fair use, I think I'm pretty well covered in terms of using images that are commercially owned by other people, as up to the point that I don't make any money off of them. But if I do, then I could see that being a problem. Plus, you know, I would have made like $30 or something like that. So it's not really worth it to me. I'd rather have them exist than make $30. So, okay, great. Thank you. How about after we... Do we have a session after this?
Yeah, there is.
Oh, okay. Abraham's about... It's 5 minutes.
I don't make the rules here.
Okay. I'll kick it off. Feel free to go or come talk to me. I'll just kick it off. We can watch it. And, yeah, we'll do that. Is that okay? All right. Thank you very much.